This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Jeff Davis, President and CEO of Aurabrush. His company's product is about as low-tech as you get. They make a better tongue cleaner. I didn't know the world needed a better tongue cleaner until I, like 20 million others, watched Aurabrush's hilarious YouTube video.
Halitophobia, the irrational fear of bad breath. I'm a halitophobic. I'm not so much afraid of me having bad breath, I'm afraid of other people having bad breath. As in, hey buddy, your breath smells like crap. Maybe you should develop a case of halitophobia.
Stay with us to hear how, in 2009, this tiny Aurum company beat every major national brand to become a leader in the new field of social marketing. In fact, even today, Aurabrush has almost as many YouTube channel views as Coca-Cola. Jeff, welcome to The Bottom Line.
It's great to be here, Doug. Thanks.
You know, Jeff, I remember several years ago, my wife came home and told me about a friend of hers, Mike Leventhal, who you know, had just done a new investment in a company, and I was talking to her about what the company did, and she told me, and of course, she didn't quite capture the vision 100%. And I've got a lot of respect for Mike. I think he's one of the best angel investors we have here in Utah. But I thought he was crazy on this one. Clearly, I was wrong. So why don't we start off? Tell us what Aurabrush does, and then tell us what you saw several years ago in Aurabrush that made you want to participate with the company.
Yeah. And by the way, Mike was the angel investor with me in Aurabrush.
Who brought who into the deal?
So Mike actually, you know, invited me in. Mike was smart enough, as you know. I just have a great respect for Mike, and he's a good friend. And when I was in my post, you know, Procter & Gamble career, Mike was one of the main gentlemen who encouraged me to return back to Salt Lake City. I'm originally from Salt Lake City. Procter & Gamble hired me out of the University of Utah, and I went in this crazy, you know, 23 years, five different country experience, you know, running billion-dollar brands and in various countries. And the question was, what was a guy like me, you know, big company, a billion-dollar guy brand, going to do back in Utah with all these entrepreneurs? And on one of my
Mike had the answer
and
for
Mike
you.
Mike had the answer. You know, Mike, I met him up in Park City on one of my trips. I was living in Frankfurt, Germany at the time, and a mutual friend, Andrew Gutman, introduced us. And Mike, I said, Mike, what's a guy like me going to do in Utah? And Mike said, Jeff, you come to Utah, and I'll find some very interesting things for you. And surely he did. And Aurabrush was one that he said, you've got to meet with these founders, and you've got to talk to them. So I, in fact, met Dr. Bob Wagstaff, 76-year-old at the time, founder of Aurabrush, created the Aurabrush, patented it, got it FDA approved, you know, tried for, you know, seven years to get someone to license the product or to sell it himself, tried an infomercial, tried all these things that didn't work. He met up then with Jeff Harmon and Neil Harmon, who we also considered founders at the time. And the original story was, you know, Jeff Harmon said, I can sell that for you on YouTube. This was in, you know, June of 2009, just slightly after YouTube had announced promoted video. You know, the Aurabrush story doesn't even happen without promoted video on YouTube.
Right.
The original bad breath video, the one that's approaching almost 20 million views, was shot in a pool hall in Provo in August of 2009. And I met with Dr. Bob and the Harmon brothers in January of 2010. I had just moved from Frankfurt, Germany to Salt Lake City in September of 2009.
So they had some traction with the video at that time.
They absolutely did. And in fact, you know, Doug, what was interesting to me, I had been dabbling in, I ran the professional salon business on a global level. The joke always was the bald guy that ran the professional hair business at P&G. But I had run that business, and we had begun to dabble in, you know, digital, knowing that we needed to try and venture out and get out of some traditional means. So when I met with them, I forget how many views they had on the YouTube channel, but it was shocking
more
and surprising.
Than P&G.
Yeah, I mean, it was shocking and surprising, definitely more than P&G. And so and other great, you know, marketing companies. And so, you know, just as Mike had anticipated, he was right. I said, wow, this is fascinating. And so Mike and I began to advise them a bit. You know, they needed some investment capital. We made the angel investment. We continued to help set up a board and get things going. And it just became more interesting and more interesting for me. And I never envisioned, you know, running Aurabrush.
Right.
I was teaching up at the university and doing some consulting and, you know, not on an airplane every Monday morning, heading somewhere in the world. So I kind of enjoyed my new life, but I was fascinated by the story. And next thing I know, I was part-time CEO. And next thing I know, about a year later, I was full-time CEO.
Which was probably Mike's plan all along. He just didn't tell you that.
You are exactly right. Anyone that knows Mike Leventhal, he had the grand plan in place. I just wasn't aware of it. So.
That's funny. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jeff Davis, CEO of Orabrush. So let's talk about the grand plan, because it sounds somewhat happenstance, the story. Dr. Bob, I believe it was a BYU class, is
right,
where he met Jeff.
Yep.
Jeff comes and says, hey, you know, I can sell this for you on YouTube. Nobody really knew what YouTube's potential was there as far as for marketing brands. It was really a place for silly videos at the time. But really out of that came a structure that I believe you guys use the term reverse marketing.
Yes.
Which really turns the world that you learned at P&G upside down. Tell us how a traditional firm does marketing like Procter & Gamble and decides to make changes to products versus how the reverse marketing model looks at it.
Yeah, great question. And really the core of the story, in my opinion. So I think, Doug, that's the core of the story. So, you know, as a 23-year guy at P&G, one of the preeminent, you know, product development and marketing companies in the world. I think they have $24 billion brands now. And, you know, the traditional model was, you know, you started out with what certainly my generation grew up with. The core of that was a great product and a marketing plan and an advertising structure to create awareness for your brand that, you know, centered on traditional means, television, you know, print, you know, billboards and, you know, the traditional magazines, the traditional stuff. And so there are two parts of the reverse marketing that I like to emphasize. So essentially the reason I coined the phrase as we were talking to a reporter, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, everything I learned, you know, from one of the best companies in the world, in my opinion, I'm doing in reverse. And the metaphor holds through almost everything I talk about. So let's talk product development first. Traditionally, you have an idea. You use a lot of third-party syndicated data on a hypothesis of who the target audience is and who would buy the product. You go make some prototypes. You do a lot of focus group testing. You would use a lot of Nielsen processes and services. You know, you do those in the consumer packaged goods world will know you do a Basis 1 test, a Basis 2 test. You do some conjoint pricing analyses. You do a lot of things that take quite a bit of time and cost quite a bit of money before you even know if this thing could fly. Mm-hmm. And so using the metaphor of reverse marketing, you know, what we basically did and what the premise was and the vision that Jeff Armon had, which we've just, you know, exploited now and are scaling, is and still today, Doug, what's interesting is it surprises me now 5 years on that I still see these major companies around the world starting, you know, with their traditional and then kind of bolting on or as an afterthought thinking about the digital media. And that surprises me especially because last year we know that online media consumption surpassed television for the first time. And so you see the consumption of media and, by the way in which it's consumed on devices dramatically, you know, shifting. And so as you think about that, what we do is we go out and we can product. We have two kind of versions of the reverse marketing model. If you take a look at our two products, Orabrush and Orapop, we essentially went out and identified the target audience. We tested pricing and packaging and messaging all in unlisted videos, on optimized videos that got lots of awareness and people would view the videos and they thought they were so interesting. They'd go to a website and they would purchase the product. And we knew in the case of Orapop, our third product we launched, and really our most deliberate reapplication of the model, we knew that we had a winner with Orapop before we ever produced the mold or a single product. We invested, and I'm actually pretty public on this, so I'm okay to share it. We invested about $250,000 of cost to develop the product virtually. And between ad spend, optimization of the pages and messaging and packaging and pricing, we actually had $750,000 of pre-order.
Wow.
Before we ever launched the product. So my metaphor of reverse thinking, mm-hmm. You know, very efficient. You know, it took about 4 to 8 months. So in 4 to 8 months, you know, $250,000. We knew we had a $1 million product on our hands before we even had invested any capital in infrastructure and supply chain and inventory.
So why do you think larger companies aren't embracing social media, embracing reverse marketing more quickly after seeing successes, after seeing the results you can get with so few dollars?
I think part of it is, you know, our generation. You and I are in a similar generation right. age for those on radio here. Right. And I think it's part of the problem. So we grew up in a different environment, a very different environment. And as an executive particularly, you could delegate most of your, you know, core disciplines and functions. You know, someone could run HR, someone could run your financial areas, someone could run supply chain. When you look at the disruption going on today, if the C-suite executives don't understand how media is being consumed and how the devices in which they're consuming that media and becoming aware of products or services is so dramatically changing, there's a real issue with that. And so the data, which are pretty compelling, I think the latest, this is either eMarketer or Forrester, they all are similar. About 60% of all media is now consumed online. Only about 25% of marketing budgets are targeted at digital. And why is that? I believe we're chained to our certitude of the 50-year model of advertising.
So you guys were doing great online. People would watch the video. They could click. They could buy the Aura brush, and it was really an online phenomenon.
Yeah.
Really hard to get it at a local store.
Yeah.
But, you know, the first big break, you guys got into some of the local Walmart stores, which is right. easier for a small company to do. Getting Walmart to carry your product nationally is really hard. People spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. I understand you guys got into Walmart spending $28. tell us that story.
Yeah, it's a funny story. And so remember I told you the reverse marketing metaphor holds through the story. The Walmart story requires just a little bit of context because it's even then more interesting. So the first customers that called from our online strategy, the first retail customers that called, because we had so much awareness on the YouTube platform on a global level, by the way, were not U.S. customers. So our initial foray into retail started internationally. Again, that's never how you would go to market right. in a major company. You'd start out with your core markets, you know, usually Western Europe or the United States, and then you would expand out to your international markets. But our first customer call came from London Drugs in Canada. We'd like to carry your product. Second call came from Boots in the UK, very difficult retailer in the UK. I know that retailer well. Third call came from a distributor in Tokyo, Japan.
Really? Wow.
I mean,
all over the world.
All
really.
Over the world. Yeah. And really strange, you know, 23 years at Procter & Gamble, no one ever called me for my new product, right? And so we ended up, you know, today we're in 25 different countries, and people say, well, why 25? Because 24 countries called me. I didn't plan to go international retail. It would have never been my choice. The only companies we did have to sell to were the U.S. retailers and therefore the story of Walmart. And because the story was so interesting, by the way, if you go on our YouTube channel, we actually shot a video about the story of how we got into Walmart.
I saw
Walmart.
That. That's why I know the $28 benchmark.
That's right. That's right. And so, again, really creativity. And people said, well, why did you tell the story on video? Because it was a one-time zeitgeist story that will never happen again. We just were leveraging again digital and social media. So the simple story was we were trying to get in, couldn't get a buyer's attention, couldn't get anyone interested to talk with us. We had done some interesting local stuff. You know, to Walmart's credit, they have this local vendor program. And so here in Utah, we went and talked to several store managers. They let us put in the product. We knew the product was turning. We knew it was successful. But we still just couldn't break in, you know, in Bentonville with the buyers there. So we took out a Facebook ad for $28. We geo-targeted the Bentonville area. If I recall, again, I may be off on our details, but if I recall, we were targeting for, you know, 40 years and up. We were trying to target the executives of Walmart to make them aware of our product. Again, quite a bold strategy. One, by the way, I probably wouldn't have approved. Most of this was done before I could have approved it.
Right.
With my young team. And we ran the ad. The ad was just completely humorous. So the ad said, you know, Walmart employees have bad breath. Now, you would never believe this, Doug, but I think it was within 72 hours I got a call from the PR department at Walmart saying, you know, if you ever want to get into Walmart, you might want to take this ad down.
Right.
They thinking,
but it did
by
get
the way,
their attention.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Got their attention. And, you know, I think it was, I think as the story goes, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, we had an order for 700,000 units of Aurabrush.
What your team at Aurabrush has been able to do is figure out how do we do this cost effectively, do it much cheaper, maybe an order of magnitude cheaper than most of your competitors. And I know we were talking earlier about kind of the next evolution for Aurabrush and really helping to provide these tools and services for firms outside of Aurabrush. Tell us about that and how you're thinking about those services for others.
Yeah, it's part of the evolution of the story. You know, those who actually follow us and know our story know actually we really weren't always just a tongue cleaner, but, you know, and or a tongue cleaner for dog. You know, Aurapup, our third product we introduced, really is this most deliberate reapplication of the model where we did both product qualification, as I talked about earlier. So, you know, we basically went out and pioneered and knew we had a winner. And then we use the platform to scale with awareness and purchase and e-commerce. We are building infrastructure and we're going to open up the reverse marketing model for other brands. And we've actually had some pretty significant partnerships that I can't talk about that give us a lot of indication that this would be successful. And you think about it, people say, oh, you're going to become an agency. Well, I'm not sure exactly. There are agency-like components of the reverse marketing model that we could use for other brands, but I don't know of an agency that has their own brands, pioneers a new model, and reapplies that new latest, greatest thinking to someone else's brand and helps them
to be
successful.
I can't think of one offhand either. There's lots of great marketing agencies that maybe brought people out of other brands.
Right.
But for the agency itself to have its own brands, I can't think of any. Though I think as a potential customer, that would be very powerful because you've pre-tested what works and what doesn't work.
So as we look at it today, and again, this is a perspective, again, from an operator, strategist, brand builder who's now become entrepreneur, small company operator with venture groups backing him. We're building a model that we think can make a huge impact in the new media world. And I suspect both with the proprietary software and the process and the system in which we will take this model and reapply now to other brands, I think that's going to become a valuable capability and a valuable company.
I think it's a very logical extension, and it takes you in the space where you have your highest and best value. I think it's also a complement to your investors, your institutional investors, True, 2X Capital, guys like Mike, that do have to look for an exit. It requires them to have a little more patience, and oftentimes it's hard for them to do that. So I agree with you. I think it's a great opportunity. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, and I think you're fortunate to have the partners that you do that will let you play that out.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and I can't emphasize that enough because, you know, this wasn't my level of expertise coming in as an angel investor, and I've come to appreciate having the right investor with you at, by the way, the very difficult times, you know, which we've had at least a few of those.
Well, let's talk company. About some of those because we've talked about a lot of the fun stuff,
yes,
a lot of the successes. And I think that can do at some point a disservice to potential entrepreneurs down the road because the reality is every company goes through a stage, if not just a pothole that they hit along the way, oftentimes it's a place where they wonder if their company is going to be around in 12 months.
Yes.
Did you have any of those experiences at Aurabrush?
Yeah, and I will count it as one of my great, you know, post big company experiences. You know, I can safely tell you that, you know, with my infinite wisdom and very, again, Procter & Gamble operating experience, you know, I almost ran us aground at least 2 or 3 times. And it was this combination of those that we had within the company that helped us significantly. You know, you don't really run a cash forecast as a general manager running a billion-dollar brand.
You look at your bank. Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
Right?
At Aurabrush, you look at your bank account every week.
And literally, you know, for periods there, you know, we have the classic story. You know, we couldn't make payroll a couple times. And of all of running a global business, and my last assignment in Procter & Gamble, I was, you know, trying to integrate, you know, Wella, the acquired company, into the P&G mothership. And, you know, some amazingly difficult periods, but there's nothing that compares to not believing you're going to make payroll on a Friday. It's just a whole new context, Doug, for me as a business leader that was very, very painful.
You have a team that they're relying on their paycheck to pay their mortgage and make their car payment.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, sorry, guys, we're not going to be able to do that this week.
Yes. So, you know, I took it very, very I think anyone takes it very seriously. But I'll tell you, those were defining moments for my team and for me as a leader and for our investors who backed us and supported us. What I can tell you, though, my learning through those most difficult times where it was, you know, friction between, you know, founder visions and investor visions, the friction between where you wanted to take it and the level of cash in the bank account, the friction of knowing that you may not have the right people in the right seats to move to the next level, all these things that every entrepreneur goes through, and by the way, are not so dissimilar from big company experiences, just with different levels of risk. What I learned, if I could capsulize it in just a brief statement, would be that the strategy and sufficiency of the strategy development that I learned in Procter & Gamble and the nimble and agility that I've learned from having to operate a small company is a good intersection. And most of the folks, Doug, that I meet with and advise or talk with here in the Valley who are brilliant, you know, I think we have just some amazing entrepreneurs here, oftentimes they lack one of the two. That intersection, strategy is important in a little company. And just zig, you know, you hear this, oh, just zig and zag. I don't believe in that. Okay. I believe that actually having thought through a number of scenarios, and in fact, the best entrepreneurs I've met through, and I have most of my experience with Silicon Valley and with here in Utah, they are in fact people who do very much what we do at Procter & Gamble in a big company from a strategy standpoint. They de-risk the downside so well. And then they place their bets and they go fast.
This is The Bottom Line. I'm speaking with Aurabrush CEO, Jeff Davis. I want to circle back. You mentioned Dr. Bob briefly, and I find his story fascinating, in part because of his age, his age and his tenacity when he came up with Aurabrush. I wanted to give you a chance to spend a couple minutes telling us Dr. Bob's story.
Yeah. I mean, I just have the highest affinity and frankly love for this man. He's the age, you know, he's a few years older than my father. And I have to tell you how every time I kind of run into him, I just kind of have to second think for a minute, because he's like an Energizer bunny. I mean, this guy is just all the time out tinkering around. I mean, you know, he's the founder of Aurabrush, the idea generator of Aurabrush. He was also the idea guy for Aurapop. You know, we had our community say, hey, Aurabrush, you need to do one of these things for dogs. Dogs have terrible bad breath. You know,
I gotta tell you, I've heard on the street that the decision to do Aurapop was not an easy decision for Aurabrush. Yeah. So if I can, I want to come back to Dr. Bob, but tell us how that decision ultimately got made and how you dealt with the folks having different views on whether you should do it or not.
Yeah, it's a good example of my previous discussion of strategy and nimble and agility, right? So the strategy of the company really was to use Aurabrush to prove the ad technology model, you know, writing, you know, the model. What is the model at Aurabrush? What's the ad technology model? We create content. We're content creators, like an agency. We're content creators. We do analytics and testing. We do A/B analytics and testing on those videos to test the viability against success metrics. And that's where our proprietary software and process is going to, you know, be quite valuable.
So we watch these videos and we all chuckle and say, oh, wouldn't that be fun to do something like that? The reality is there's a lot of science, there's a lot of statistics going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and it's really important, Doug. I mean, we haven't actually talked that, and it is really important because we're often known, in fact, often the media talks about us as a viral sensation. You know what? There's nothing viral about the reverse marketing model at Orbrush. It's a model. Viral is not a model.
Good for you. That makes you much more valuable. That's
exactly right. And so, you know, the three-pronged part of the reverse marketing model is content creation, analytics and A/B optimization. And then, by the way, we're the media company. We're placing the optimized media. And the integration of those three is what we believe can be a very important capability for a brand in the new space in which, you know, awareness is created. And so with that model, if I go back to the strategy and the serendipity of Orapup, this is the beauty, by the way, of having, you know, these engaged fans on our channels. They started to really, I mean, it became a very theme about this dog thing. And so we talked about it, and, you know, for me, I was on the strategy. I said, guys, you know, let's stay focused. Let's really keep rolling along here in what we're doing. You know, we're building out the retail footprint. We're learning more on the model on our own brand. You know, we were testing with some other companies at the time. We had a couple of other companies. And by the way, I can't, you know, say who they are, but some major companies, major consumer packaged goods companies, and even a major direct response company, because we think of ourselves kind of as infomercial-like direct response advertising. Right. You know, we're really a direct response advertiser on the medium of YouTube. And we know how to create the content, we know how to optimize it, and we know how to buy at a very low cost per view.
Which brings us back to Dr. Bob.
Yeah.
Because I know he tried everything
before
he met Jeff Harmon, including he came out of pocket with a fair number of dollars to do an infomercial.
Absolutely.
And it bombed.
It bombed.
So let's go back to Dr. Bob's story. So he comes up with this vision for a better way to clean your tongue.
Right.
He's in his late 60s, early 70s. He gives it what I would consider, you know, 100% effort. 5 years later, hasn't succeeded. Most guys would just hang up their hat and say, I gave it the college try.
Especially, by the way, at that age, right?
Exactly.
I mean, Bob likes to golf. I love to get out on the golf course. I'm like, Bob, why don't you just, you know.
What kept him going? What kept him motivated?
You know, I think it's this DNA chip of entrepreneurs. And I can't tell you how I've been impressed with identifying that. I've seen it in a different way with different larger companies. You know, sometimes the entrepreneurs have not actually done it themselves. Part of that is the magic of why we invest in people like that. Mm-hmm. And part of it is why they never get out of first gear on any of their ideas, because they don't understand the need to also have some flexibility from people that have done it or done versions of it that could take the idea and actually build it into something.
And you're never too late to be an entrepreneur, as demonstrated by Dr. Bob.
That's right.
Our guest today is Jeff Davis. He's the president and CEO of Orbrush. He's also very happy that he decided to be one of the early investors in the company. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. I love telling the story. Thank you.
The Bottom Line is recorded at KCPW Studio on Library Square and is produced by Ross Chambliss, with technical support from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. I'm Doug Wells. See you next week.